Conversations with Apollo, episode number 3, Honeysuckle, part 2.
In the whole history of man, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world.
My next guest is John Saxon, who worked at the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station during the Apollo program. Welcome to Conversations with Apollo, John.
Hi, James. Nice to be with you.
Well, I'm certainly glad to have your perspective. As you know, we had Mike Dinn on during the last episode. He gave us the viewpoint from a managerial point of view, and I thought it would be really great to take a look at it from a different perspective. So why don't you go ahead and tell us what was your job at Honeysuckle?
Well, I was employed as an operations supervisor which entailed sitting on the main console, which was a two-man console during Apollo. And I was employed from England, actually. I had visited Australia a couple of times before on another project, dropping nasty things at the weapons range at Woomera from large bombers. And really, when I had to go back to the UK, I couldn't wait to get back to Australia, and interviewed for a couple of space tracking stations down here, as I'd always been interested in space. And was lucky enough to be accepted by both of them. The first one to take me on was actually the Deep Space Station at Tibimbilla, and I hope you didn't hear that. That was an Outlook reminder. The Deep Space Station at Tibimbilla, and they were going to employ me as a shift supervisor there, and I was lucky enough then to get interviewed by the contractor who was running the new Apollo station maintenance and operations at Honeysuckle. And I have to say that after that interview, I felt, well, you know, manned space flight's a bit more exciting than deep space. Or at least I felt that at the time, and probably still do. And so I accepted the manned space flight one, and joined the staff at Honeysuckle Creek after doing a training course for maintenance and operations supervisors in the Goddard Space Flight Center in near Maryland.
Now, what during what time was this?
This a long time ago.
Was it during Gemini? Was it during Apollo? Purely Apollo? Where in the timeline did you actually get to Honeysuckle?
Okay, it was right towards the end of the Gemini missions. I think, if I remember rightly, the last but one Gemini mission was in progress when I was at Greenbelt in Maryland. And we did not support Gemini at Honeysuckle. The station was not finished before the end of the Gemini mission. So we started fresh with Apollo. And it was an interesting period at the start because we were all very green, of course, and hadn't had any experience with space tracking, the vast majority of us. And we needed whipping into shape, that was certain. And that became very apparent when we had the first tracking aircraft simulations, which came, the NASA Super Constellations came down and simulated the Apollo spacecraft and the astronauts and everything else. And they were very difficult. The first difficulty was that it's very hard to track an aircraft with a 85-foot antenna, 26 meters, we say these days.
Kind of hard to turn it on a dime.
You really need to be able to get it in the beam width of the antenna, which is quite small, And if the aircraft is not spot on in terms of position in space and time, then you've really got to struggle to lock on the receivers and auto track the antenna to follow the aircraft. And that was only the start of the troubles, of course, because the simulation teams, which were very, very good, I felt, used to come down and really give us a very hard time. They would cause all sorts of crises to occur, and there'd be an observer in each section of the tracking station, and they would really work this tracking station over. Later on, as I'm sure Mike explained, we built our own simulation consoles and were able to wring out the staff even more. We can maybe talk about simulations a bit later, but perhaps you'd like me to carry on from the start of the station operations?
Yeah, starting off with the station operations, although I do note here that you had the unique experience of playing Capcom on Apollo 16 briefly, by talking to Young and Duke directly from the lunar surface?
Yes, I was very lucky in that the position that I operated on the console was one which was monitoring the air-ground conversations, and we did have the capability with a push of a button to talk to the spacecraft. And I do have a story about Apollo 8 where I was very, very close to being the first man to talk to anybody in lunar orbit, but maybe get to that later when we start covering some of the missions. But on Apollo 16, we had an outage, a communications outage with Houston, and so when the astronauts called down, Houston didn't respond. I had to start talking and let them know that we were sorting things out. Turned out in the end that the first thing that John Young said was, I could do with a swan. I don't know if you know anything about Apollo 16 mission, but most of the lunar operations were run with the LEM on the Omni antenna. Mm-hmm. It was a problem with the high gain, and there was a hell of a lot of noise on the line coming down from the spacecraft. Most unusual. Usually there was more noise on the ground communications than there was on the communications to and from the moon. But on this occasion, Apollo 16, there was a lot of downlink noise on and went right over my head. I couldn't understand what the heck he was saying. So it was somewhat embarrassing.
Can you briefly go over the difference between the Omni antenna and the high gain antenna?
Well, the high gain was a steerable antenna which produced a much better signal level on the ground than the Omni antennas, which were not nearly as directional. Therefore, if you have an antenna which is very directional, pointing at the ground, then you're going to get a better signal level and better signal-to-noise ratios. And consequently, as there was a failure with a high-gain antenna mechanism on the lunar module Apollo 16, the crew had to revert to the Omni or sort of universal antennas, which are very low gain, very low signal level, and very high noise. So, unfortunately, my small moment of triumph when I actually managed to talk to somebody on the lunar surface was somewhat spoiled by all this downlink noise. But all that said, John Young said I could really do with a swan. It turned out later that he had been to the Carnarvon tracking station in Western Australia, and Swan Lager is the Western Australian local beer.
Ah.
So
it must be pretty good then.
Eventually, yes, we had a little conversation about Swan Lager and the fact that I mentioned we'd keep them cool for them, and if they came down here we'd make sure they had one or two. Swan in fact got hold of that story, the brewery got hold of the story, and sent the astronauts a crate or two of the good stuff, and I believe they enjoyed them when they got back. In the meantime, we heard about that and rang up the brewery and said, look, we have splashdown parties as well, you know. And I think we ended up with 68 dozen or something, large bottles. I had a good splashdown party anyhow.
Oh, I'd bet. Now, according to your bio at honeysucklecreek.net, which is basically the website for Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station, to remember it, you said here that you personally picked Apollo 8 as your favorite mission with 15 a close second. Why 8?
Oh, I think just about everybody in the business just was flabbergasted by the sheer gall and courage of everything was a first on Apollo 8. You know, they'd never been more than 850 miles above the surface of the Earth, and here they were on top of a brand new rocket, never been man-rated before, although we'd done a couple of test flights. And here they were blasting off for the moon and going into orbit for the first time around another body. And I have to say, selfishly, that it was the first time we really came into our own, as we were one of the three prime stations for lunar orbit operations and lunar surface operations. So
the other two being Goldstone in California
and Madrid in Spain, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I think we all preferred the lunar missions with the large antennas because A, we had a prime role, and B, we got the best signals around the network generally. So it was a pretty incredible mission, and I'm still bowled over by the fact that they took so many risks, and yet it worked out so well.
And there we go. That was a little bit of John Saxon's conversation with John Young about having a swan. And John, I noticed on the Honeysuckle Creek website, you finally got to have that swan with John Young a few years ago, didn't you?
That's right. Well, John came down to Australia two or three times after that mission, and I never thought it was very appropriate to sort of crash in on anybody else's celebrations. So we actually had him as guest of honor on our 25th anniversary of Apollo 11, and that was an ideal opportunity. So I was able to share a swan with him, and he very definitely remembered the conversation, and so I believed as Charlie Duke, who was also joined in on that occasion.
Okay, so when we were last talking before the break, we were talking about your story from Apollo 8, and how it was the first time you considered Apollo 8 your favorite mission because of the sheer audacity of the mission in and of itself, and the fact this would be the very first time you'd have the entire lunar mission being picked up by the Deep Space Tracking Network.
Yes, well, we weren't really part of the Deep Space Tracking Network at that point. We were definitely Manned Spaceflight Network, which was a separate network. And however, there were the three stations, as we mentioned, who were specifically for the lunar distance operations. And I guess what happened when they initially went into Earth lunar orbit behind the moon for the first time. First time they'd ever been out of contact with the Earth for any reasonable period. And they did the orbit burn, or the burn into orbit behind the moon, and there was some concern that that burn might not have occurred properly, and that they would come out at slightly different times from occultation behind the moon. In the event, they did come out from occultation, and we had acquisition of signal spot on time, so it was pretty obvious that the burn had been successful. However, because the station had a lot of extra equipment for multiple spacecraft, like not only the command module, service module, the lunar module, the astronaut extravehicular backpacks, etc., etc., lunar rover later on, there was a lot of extra equipment that was not in use on Apollo 8, and we had configured some of that extra equipment. In fact, the voice bus for the lunar module we had configured for backup voice or an emergency mode voice, just in case they had to use that when they came out from behind the moon. In the event, there were two people looking for where the voice was coming from. Was it coming down under the backup voice system, which was on the baseband of the signal, or was it coming down on a subcarrier in the normal voice mode? And the guy who was running the subcarrier demodulators, where this sort of decision was made, he was searching around to find out which mode of voice it was, and I was looking at the command module and lunar module buses to find out where the voice was, and I'm afraid we were sort of contradicting each other here and there, and there was a little bit of confusion, I hate to admit it, even after all this time. So I very definitely remember the voice of Apollo PR person saying, yes, we have data, but no voice. No voice, and here it is, the first time they've come out from behind the moon. If you listen to the recordings of that time, you will hear that. And here was the fellow down the front end on the demodulators pushing all the buttons. I was pushing all the buttons, and I was within a few seconds of pushing the button to go and talk to them and say, look, I'm sorry, but we've screwed up down here somewhere. And we'll get back with you shortly. But in fact, we got it sorted very quickly, and I missed my chance at being the first person to speak to anybody in lunar orbit. But however, I mean, all of this pales into insignificance compared with the guys who were in the Houston Control Center, who regularly talked to the spacecraft, of course. Usually they were astronauts who were not on that particular mission, doing the CAPCOM. And so, you know, when it's very unusual that the systems had very good diversity, very good extra equipment to allow for contingencies. We had multiple antennas, multiple stations, multiple voice downlinks that could be selected from. It was pretty unusual for anybody in the stations to actually speak to the spacecraft, so I was happy when I did finally get my chance on Apollo 16. Along the way, we had other people. Mike had a quick conversation with Apollo 8 on its way to the moon, I think, while I was having my lunch. And one of the other guys on Apollo 17, I think, in Transearth. But I was the only person who was lucky enough to actually speak to somebody on the lunar surface from a ground station, as far as I'm aware.
Now, also in your bio, it says here that you have fond memories of Apollo 15 because of the strange or weird rover voice.
I don't think so.
It says here, but 15 was a close second. major increases in complexity with the extra CSM experiments, and the weird rover voice and data configurations. That's the first time the TV was halfway decent. When you say weird voice data configurations, it was just the way they had it all set up. It was kind of counterintuitive.
Not counterintuitive at all, but it was just a very large extra level of complexity, particularly from the voice point of view. There was so many possibilities. You could configure the voice to go direct from the backpacks to the lunar module, to the ground, to the Houston, to go up through another station perhaps, and then back down again via another spacecraft, all types of configurations.
But plus the rover itself had a major antenna in it, didn't it?
It had an antenna which was actually pointed manually by the astronauts. The situation was that they were supposed to go onto a low-gain antenna while they were driving around on the lunar surface, and then when they stopped at a station, they would manually point the higher gain antenna at the Earth, and I think that was the situation. I'm not even sure if I had a low gain antenna. Maybe we communicated via another path. But anyhow, it's a long time ago now.
Yeah, a few years.
But they manually pointed the antenna back at Earth, and the signal level was generally fairly good, and not being relayed via the lunar module. Now, the poor fellow at the front end had, this is at the signal data demodulators where all the voice and telemetry data was sorted out from the various input sources and going out to the various processing equipments. He had to determine what the best quality was, whether it was coming from the lunar rover or direct, or whether it was from the lunar module, which was a relay situation, or whether it was the best voice was coming from a larger antenna like Parkes or Tibimbilla was providing a better signal. So he had numerous inputs which he was trying to sort out which were the best ones, and he was not helped by the astronauts, who quite easily understood. They used to get fairly excited driving around on the lunar surface, and was not something you do every day. And so they'd often leave the antenna, the high gain antenna, pointed and switched over to that while they were driving along. And so consequently, the signals used to be dropping in and out, and the relay via the LEM would be dropping in and out, and it was a really horrendous job to keep track of all this lot, and I'm amazed it worked as well as it did, quite frankly.
As they call it, high maintenance.
Yeah, I remember before the first EVA, Apollo 11, they had a very strict sequence of tests when they were donning their suits and powering up the suit communications, VHF, S-band, all the other things. And the many, many different modes of voice communication, as well as the biomedical information and everything else. So they were supposed to go via a very, very formal sequence of tests. And I don't think it went like that on any mission. But Apollo 11, I thought, was particularly bad in that the sequence wasn't really followed quite the way we expected, and again, this poor fellow at the front end, and me badgering him, everybody badgering him to pick the right voice at the right times. It sounds like it was chaotic. It wasn't as chaotic as all as that, but it certainly got the adrenaline flowing when things don't happen exactly as forecast.
You were certainly earning your paychecks during those times.
I think so, yes. Not so much myself. I mean, I was just really sort of in between Houston and the equipment that was, and the guys who were operating that equipment, who were doing the the real job, my job was just to make sure that everything was working the way it should and to make sure the relays were operating the way they should, that the tones were switching the voice to the uplinks satisfactorily and that type of thing. So that was only a small part of my job on the console, was sort of overseeing the voice side of things. There was many other things we had to do, including looking after the command and telemetry computers. Some of the operations on those were run from the console, probably listening to five or six voice nets and working all of those at the same time, keeping a station log, which was not mandatory, but we did end up keeping logs because you never know when you're going to be asked after the event what happened and when it happened. So it was a fairly busy position, and as I say, the voice part of it was only one part of it. Well, one interesting thing that we used to do with the voice was, I don't know if Mike explained to you about the Quindar tones, these tones of, you know, beep, here's Houston, Houston out, beep, a different frequency, much loved by people doing space movies. Those Quindar tones actually switched the ground networks between ourselves and Houston to the transmitters, or the transmitters going up to the astronauts, the idea being that during periods when Houston wasn't talking, the noise on the circuits did not get up to the astronauts and trigger their communications, voice-operated equipment and that type of thing. So one of the things we had to do was to sort of keep a wary eye on the uplink modulation, the fact that the voice was actually going up to the spacecraft when Houston triggered that equipment to switch over from the ground line to the transmitter. And occasionally they weren't 100% reliable because there was the communication circuits in those days were not digital, they were analog, and consequently things used to drift and phase changes and things on the lines could upset the triggering of these relays. So that was another little job that if Houston called and it didn't trigger the uplink, then I had to rapidly push the button as if I was going to talk to the spacecraft, but keep pushing it and releasing it as Houston triggered their voice. Very crude.
Got the job done, though.
Yeah, it got the job done. And unfortunately, quite often, well, not often, but it was not abundantly obvious to other people that this was going on. So you'd get a voice in one ear and getting into your microphone going up to the spacecraft while you were busily trying to allow Houston to do that. So there could be some difficulties. I must get back to the fact that these were contingency procedures which were not operated that often. On the whole, you know, 99.9% of the time things went fairly well. I guess Apollo 13 was the exception to that rule. Mike, I'm sure, has already talked about that. But 99% of the time things went extremely well. That's one reason why I don't think too many of us would include Apollo 11 as being the ultimate mission from the technical point of view, at least, because even though in retrospect it was a highly historical time, etc., etc., and we're very proud of the fact that it was our television that went out to the world, etc., etc., we consider that Apollo 11 was a bit like a simulation without all the problems. It went extremely well. It went smoothly, despite the fact that there was a fair bit of new stuff there. Obviously, nobody had ever landed on the moon or walked on it from our point of view. There was a lot of extra activity.
Much less route a television signal and a president's telephone call.
Yes, I wrote in my log, Nixon uplinking, a brief entry, but I suppose it was reasonably historic at the time. No, that's a, is that an oxymoron or something when you say reasonably historic at the time? After the event, it seems to be a reasonably historic occasion with the president uplinking. That was, that in itself was an unusual situation that we'd never had before, in that we were running a relay between the voice uplink to the LEM and also simultaneously to the CSM. But so there were many, many communications configurations which allowed, you know, one site to uplink, but that uplink side would also come into our station and could be relayed to another spacecraft and this type of thing. It seems reasonably trivial, I suppose, in this digital age when you can probably just make a type in to do that type of thing. But
or when you consider that we're using Skype right now to have this conversation over the internet, it's not that much of a reach to remotely consider somebody, say, living on Mars or, you know, on Mars, using an internet using a radio broadcast to have a conversation with somebody who's talking to them over the internet. I mean that's kind of out there, but I mean you get what I'm saying. Is you're going from a telephone in the Oval Office to the switching, which then moves it over to the uplink, which takes it over across the radio waves to the command module, over to the lunar module, and into their backpacks. It's kind of like a big gigantic daisy chain.
Yeah, well, it didn't happen quite that way, but nevertheless, it was quite a complex operation. Most of it coordinated through a couple of people at Goddard Space Flight Center who were the voice controllers for the entire network. There was, as you know, there was probably 20 or 30 tracking stations of one kind or another in the Apollo network, and they all had voice circuits, and some of them were uplinking, some of them were downlinking, and so on. It could get reasonably complicated. And as for your comment about extending the internet out to Mars and things, believe it or not, I worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory for a while in Pasadena, who do the deep space missions, as you know, and they had plans quite a few years ago to extend the internet literally out to other planets. And, of course, the real problem with all of that is latency on the signals. The way the internet works at the moment is that you sort of send out a block of information and you get an acknowledgement back. That's not going to happen when you, even at the moon, it's a bit tricky because you've got total around about 2 seconds round trip time to the lunar surface.
Right, and Mars is like 20 minutes or something like that.
Well, depending upon how close Mars is to Earth, probably the shortest round trip is around 20 minutes to Mars, yes.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Voice was always an interesting aspect of these missions. It was, in terms of priority, I suppose you could say that the biomedical data was probably first priority. Second priority would have been voice. Third priority probably television. Telemetry data, and then maybe television would come in about four. Certainly it was treated that way until I think the mission control and the powers that be in Houston realized that the public were interested in seeing television from the moon.
And then Apollo 12 happened.
Yeah, that was unfortunate. I have a good friend who was handling the television equipment on the ground here at Honeysuckle and for Apollo 12, and he could see what was happening. he could see that camera getting pointed at the sun and the tearing of the picture as the Vidicon died in the camera. And he told me, he still tells me that, you know, he just was almost speechless with horror watching this occur. So it was nice when they got to Apollo 14 and they got some sort of television for a change. And then Apollo 15 went to a much better system, and the pictures were really quite reasonable. But by that time, I guess the public was getting less enamored with the whole program, so it wasn't watched as much.
Which is really too bad, because there's really great shots taken during the during Apollo 15, 16, and 17, especially during the live liftoff, where we actually saw the lunar module lift off from the moon. I remember
that when I
was a kid.
Yes, the man who did that, of course, was a friend of ours, a good friend called Ed Fendell, and he was the communications coordinator at Houston, capsule communications, not the Capcom, but a position called INCO. Not even sure what it stands for anymore, but anyhow, to sit on the consoles there and send the commands to the camera on the lunar rover. And the neat thing was that we could see those commands coming through the station going up to the rover in English. The command computer equipment would actually translate the data into English commands like pan left, tilt up, zoom out, iris open, iris closed, you know, this type of thing. And Ed Fendell's fingers were really magic on those commands. And of course, every command had to be sent some 2 seconds or more before the action took place.
So he really had to time it.
He really had to time it, and he tried on 15, he tried, nearly got it on 16, and finally got it on 17. And he just couldn't get the final commands out in time to follow it all the way up. Various people were fairly upset that the spacecraft gradually drifted out above the picture because he just couldn't get those tilt-up commands in fast enough, I don't think. But it was a splendid effort. I mean, all of that would be sort of pre-programmed these days, and there'd be some I don't know, signal down from the spacecraft that said, I'm going to do my thing, start filming, start tilting,
or
whatever.
Some infrared trigger that would pick up the lunar module taking off, and then it would just engage.
Something like that.
Technical thing.
Yeah.
I tell you, one thing that I found really stunning about that whole moment when we saw the lunar module lift off from the moon's surface, although it was really cool to actually see it lift off, after it was gone, and then I remember very vividly them switching back to what was left of the lunar module on the lunar surface, and just how lonely and desolate that moment was, because they were gone. And I think about that from time to time. I often wonder if we could just turn that camera back on, just to see how well the lunar modules are holding up that actually have the rovers, and so you could actually see how 38 years of wear and tear on the lunar surface has actually how they've held up. I think about that from time to time.
They actually did that on previous missions. I think they did it on 15 and 16. We could see all that stuff at the stations when they just sort of panned back or tilted back down and looked at the rover. In fact, they were commanding, looking around the sites, looking at the surface packages and things like that for a short while afterwards. I think probably the saddest thing was the fact that they had all those packages on the moon in different locations, with science data coming back for years afterwards, but they were eventually turned off because they needed to reuse the frequencies. It just boggles the mind that I believe that was the reason. Well, there was probably ancillary reasons such as budget considerations. All of these sort of things take money, but they turned them off. And in fact, they turned off the command receivers on those packages so that they could no longer receive a command to turn them back on, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And those packages would probably still be active. They were, except for Apollo 11 and Apollo 13, which never made it, all those other packages were powered by atomic batteries, and they would probably still be able to transmit and give us some data if they could be turned back on.
I'd like to know who made that decision to turn them off.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I remember hearing that that even though they've officially discontinued some of the early deep space probes over at JPL, every once in a while they fire them up for training purposes. And
well, yes, not just for training purposes. The Pioneer missions going around the sun, some of those were designed for 6 months and they were celebrating the 25th anniversary. You know, they'd wake them up and give them a birthday present, say, hello, here we are, send us a bit more data, because they would store up data between these very brief encounters. Yes, it's a matter of budget in a lot of cases, I'm sure. I'm not privy to all of that sort of thing, but and there's a limited number of people. There's always the next mission. You know, there's people who are wanting to push ahead all the time, and unfortunately, past missions are past missions. They don't, as far as the operations are concerned, they're not so keen to carry them on.
Okay, in closing from our time here together, I have a couple of really quick, four really quick questions for you. What was your high point of your Apollo experience?
That's a good question. I suppose I'd have to say it would have been the Apollo 16 chat with John Young, even though it was fairly incoherent. It was something that I was hoping I'd get to do before the last mission, so I was happy about that. There's plenty of graffiti written at the station that I fixed the whole thing, but I can assure everybody it was not the case.
Okay, and what was how about your low point?
I don't know that operationally there was a low point. I think even Apollo 13, which was such a struggle and rather difficult, was good from the point of view that it was a finally got the astronauts back. So that could not be considered a low point. I think perhaps I could bring up the subject of simulations again, and occasionally I would be on the side that handed out the punishment to the rest of the troops as opposed to being on the receiving end of problems. The sort of thing we used to do was to maybe set off a fire alarm, or somebody would be pre-briefed to fake a heart attack in the middle of some operational area and have to be carted off on a stretcher while things carried on. You know, these were the sort of, not tricks, but things that we practiced. And one thing was that I used to occasionally go around and sneak behind a rack of equipment and pull out a module or a card, or just loosen it a bit. And the poor guy who was looking after that equipment would have to find the fault in a hurry, rush off to the stores with a stopwatch going, see how quickly he could get a replacement and get the equipment going again. And I did that to a guy who was running the microwave link between ourselves and the Deep Space Station, pulled a module out of there, and he actually backed me up against the wall and was threatening to thump me when he found out what was going on. He was and the worst thing was I had to share a car with him going home that evening.
But, well, that must have been a quiet conversation.
No, it wasn't. I got an earful all the way home. Well, yeah, so that I suppose you could say that was a bit of a low point, but when I say there was lots of highs and not very many lows. We were fantastically lucky to be able to be employed in that business at that time, and to be a small part of that massive iceberg, somewhere near the tip in some ways. I mean, obviously the crew and Houston and everybody else were way above us, but we were all links in the chain, so it was wonderful.
My other two questions are, have you been following the new Moon and Mars initiative, and what are your thoughts about it?
Well, I have to say I'm retired, James, and when you retire, believe it or not, you get busier than when you were working. And the short answer is no. I'm interested. I worked for 17 years in the deep space side at our sister station here in Canberra, and we were again incredibly lucky doing, you know, the first landings on Mars, the Voyager missions, fantastic missions around the sun, etc., etc. So we've been extremely lucky in that regard, that we've had a lion's share of many of those missions. As I say, I do get out to the Deep Space Station occasionally and like to try and catch up, but on a day-to-day basis, I'm afraid I'm not keeping up with it at all well.
Then my final question is that, imagine some young guy who is doing a job similar to yours as we go back to the moon and even onto Mars. And if he needed a moment of inspiration and he comes across this particular episode of the podcast because it interests him because you did a job similar to his, it's four decades past, what do you say to those young guys who are actually doing the job that you trailblazed and pioneered four decades ago?
Oh, I think, I hate to sound like a wise old man, the old part applies, but enjoy the moment, for goodness sake. It's not just a job, it's something to treasure. So really enjoy it when you can. I think that's what I'd like to say to them. You can tell the morale of a group of people to a certain extent by the amount of graffiti they generate. By graffiti, I mean cartoons, poems, songs, and similar things. And we had lots down at Honeysuckle. And this one was not actually written at Honeysuckle, but I'll read you the very first verse of The Principles of Communications. And I have to say that this is absolutely typical of most ground communications, and anybody who works in that field will know exactly what we're talking about. But this is called The Principles of Communications, verse 1, or I'm All Right at the Test Jack. And it goes like this: as we cluster around the console, there's a gleam in every eye. For today we prove the circuit, or at least today we try. We're going to check the lineup all the way from end to end. It's a network competition. You win any time you send. The sending end is always perfect, and we are the sending site. So rest assured the signal will be leaving here all right. And then it goes on from there, about 10 verses.
I think that pretty much wraps up our perfectly our look at the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station. For more information about the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station, you can visit the website at www.honeysucklecreek.net. Thanks for joining us, John.
You're welcome, James. Nice to talk to you.
You've been listening to Conversations with Apollo, a weekly podcast for space history fans everywhere. For more information, visit our MySpace page at www.myspace.com/conversationswithapollo. Or you can leave us feedback on our iTunes website. And if you know anyone who worked on the Apollo program who has a story to tell, we want to hear it. Just have them drop us a line at apollotalks@gmail.com. Theme music is from Gemini 5, courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network. The song is Babylon Rockets. Visit them on the web at www.gemini5.com. Conversations with Apollo is a copyrighted podcast under the Creative Commons license from Quindar Entertainment. Copyright 2007.